107 immigrants are reported to have died while in detention in the United States since October 2003, when the Agency for Immigration and Customs Enforcement was created within the Department of Homeland Security. Last August, the Obama administration announced an overhaul of the system. Few facts have been made available about the people who've died and what happened to them. But New York Times immigration reporter Nina Bernstein has been investigating some of their stories and has uncovered new evidence that indicates officials may be deliberately trying to keep facts about their deaths out of the public eye. Her most recent article on the matter appeared in the Times on January 10th. I'm very pleased to welcome Nina Bernstein back to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
When you were on our show in August, you said these deaths are like windows into a system which is incredibly secretive. But a spokesman for the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, Brian P. Hale, promised transparency and greater oversight. We began to see that?
Well, I think there are some good signs. The main thing I think that has been done that's extraordinary in comparison to the past is that there are they actually post on their website new deaths, which, you know, before it was completely secretive. But I have to say that the Freedom of Information documents that I was able to get over the last several months include some from emails from last August that really still show a culture of secrecy in Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
They're trying to stymie inquiries into what's going on?
That's been the history, that definitely.
Is it because some of the officials involved were there before and they may be protecting their own behinds?
Well, I think that's a part of it. Certainly, many of the same people who were overseeing the system before, or key players, are in the same roles.
So what happens when you put in a FOIA request? Do you have to really fight? It's you and the Civil Liberties Union, isn't it?
Well, we haven't been doing this together. It's kind of, we've been on, you could say, parallel tracks. This really, for me, this story really starts 3 years ago with an email that I got from a lawyer I didn't know about a detainee at the Elizabeth Detention Center in New Jersey who had ended up, he'd been badly injured and he'd been put in isolation. And then he'd been taken away more dead than alive, and they didn't know what had happened to him. And my effort to look into this is what led me eventually to file a Freedom of Information request. It took months for me to even get a list on which I recognized the garbled name that had been given to me, that had been passed to me, something like Abubakar. Meanwhile,
he was a Ghanaian tailor.
That's right, a 52-year-old Ghanaian tailor.
And he came to this country legally or illegally?
He came on a tourist visa legally, but he overstayed that visa to work. He really was a part of the fabric of New York, I would say, you know, including making, sewing these gowns that sold for $2,000 in a boutique in the Village. He tried very hard and spent a lot of money trying to legalize his status, and thought that he was on the road to doing so when he went to Africa for a visit on and was stopped on his way back at the airport.
And how long was he in detention?
He was in detention for about a year total. I think it had been about 9 months at the time that he had this kind of mysterious injury.
Do we know what caused the injury?
According to the records that I have seen, he passed out. He fell in the bathroom area of the dorm backwards and hit his head. But
something that just happens?
Well, that's the thing. You know, you really don't know what preceded it. It seems very odd that falling backwards and hitting his head would account for the injuries, the fractured skull, and the multiple brain hemorrhages that were eventually discovered. It's all unclear, but Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say is what we do know is that the signs of intracranial bleeding that experts have told us were should have been evident were not evident to apparently were missed by the ICE Public Health Service doctors. And they treated him as a disciplinary case.
Wasn't he shackled while he was in the
yes,
hospital?
He was in the medical unit of the detention center, which is run by Corrections Corporation of America, a publicly traded private prison company. He was basically put on the ground, shackled, and we now have video of this. And it's
why
on.
Was it filmed?
It's part of their procedure, part of policy. Essentially, this was a use of force on a detainee, and it's supposed to be videotaped, essentially to guard against abuse. I mean, curiously, the trip then from the medical unit to the isolation cell, where he was left for 13 hours without treatment, which should have been filmed. Supposedly, the video camera did not function properly. At least we don't have that videotape.
Was his family informed that this had happened?
No. I mean, that's another hallmark of these cases.
Do the families even know where these guys are?
Sometimes it's very hard for the family to find out where someone is. There are these multiple transfers that occur. Not in this instance. In this instance, the family members were family members in New York who had been involved. They were not notified of this serious injury. When he was finally taken to the hospital, and it was discovered that he had a skull fracture and these brain hemorrhages, and he needed emergency brain surgery, they still were not notified. And they learned about it through a former roommate who heard from another detainee.
Wasn't it proposed that he be sent back to Guinea while he was in a coma?
Yes. This is the piece of the story, of the puzzle, really, that I only learned more recently. There are emails, there are confidential memos memorializing these conversations by teleconferences by 10 managers in Newark and Washington, D.C., where indeed, you know, they talked about how to deport him to Africa while he was still unconscious, you know, in a coma, or renew his work permit so that they could get him on Medicaid and get him off there. You know, essentially, they wanted to shed responsibility for this man.
In fact, there was a problem figuring out who was going to pay for his medical bills after he died.
Yeah, especially before he died, you see, there was this period when for 4 months he was in a coma. And the hospital wanted to release him. He was in a vegetative state. He no longer needed hospital care. And it was very expensive. The nursing home care was going to cost $10,000 a month. And ICE didn't want it. That's Immigration and Customs Enforcement didn't want it on their budget.
But they were the cause, weren't they? And he was in custody, so that he's their responsibility.
One of the ironies here is that they had guards. They were paying guards to be at his bedside while he was in a coma because he was in custody. And yet, ultimately, they end up deciding the way we're going to deal with this is we're going to discharge him to his relatives, though they have said they have no way to care for him.
This was a front page story in the New York Times in May 2008. What was the official reaction?
The official reaction was defensive. They reacted the same way they reacted, but 4 days later, the Washington Post, this is just coincidental, but the Washington Post did a four-part series about substandard medical care in detention. And essentially, there was this full court press by the administration to try to say that detention care was fine and mortality rates were low.
My guess is Nina Bernstein of the New York Times, she has been writing about deaths of immigrants in detention. over the years, and we're talking about what we know so far. You mentioned that in this case he was in a private jail?
That's correct.
Is that typical?
Many of the more than 300 facilities where immigrants are held in detention are privately run.
Now, what happens? Okay, so an immigrant like this man comes, he comes into the United States, he's on a list, they arrest him. What do they send him to a privately run detention center?
That's right.
Does he get to make a telephone call, call a lawyer?
Well, there are different circumstances in which people are picked up, of course. And in this case, he was stopped at the airport. And so you have this sort of anomaly. They essentially said, we're not letting him, we're excluding him, we're not letting him in the country. To fight his case, he could have turned around and gone back to Guinea at that point. But this was a man who had been really trying very hard to legalize his status, who had ties, who had a life here, and who had been granted permission by the immigration system, in effect, to go to travel. And it had been denied, then his application had been denied while he was gone, and his permission revoked. So he found himself having to fight this case from detention.
But what about some of the other cases? I don't want to go into all
yes.
of them, but Nery Romero, a Salvadoran who was held in a Bergen County jail, that was a regular jail. Was he held with criminals?
Yes. And to be fair, Nery Romero fit the category of that is called criminal alien, and we're hearing a lot from the Obama administration now, as we did actually from the Bush administration as well, that this is a priority to go after people who have committed crimes. But Nery Romero was a 22-year-old who had come legally at age 11, and he got into he had a record of I would say pretty low level. Criminal activity, but they had tagged him as a suspected gang member. So this was part of this idea of we're going to sweep the communities of these people. In fact, he was on probation. He was with his parents, who were legal residents or possibly even becoming citizens. And they picked him up at home, and he had a smashed leg from a motorcycle accident. He was on a heavy painkiller, which the family told the ICE officers, but he ended up in this county jail, and later an investigation that was not made public until I was able to get it, and the ACLU as well, which litigated. You know, you talked about that. Sometimes it's very hard to get these documents. You can't just put in a request. You have to go to court to fight the denials. Anyway, Nery Romero ended up not only cut off the narcotic painkiller that he was on and in extreme pain, but an order for Motrin apparently was not filled, or at least the record was falsified, so that one of the doses that he was supposedly given of this painkiller was given after he was already dead.
Falsified.
Yeah.
You've written for years they went uncounted and unnamed in the public record. So was anybody even keeping track of what was going on? And what happens when somebody falsifies a record? Is that noted by the people in charge?
I think this is what's so dispiriting, really, is the question of accountability. You find that, I mean, for all these years, people were unnamed and uncounted. It was very hard to get a list of names of people who had died, where, and then to find out who they were was even harder. But come to find out, there were actually thousands of pages of government documents that weren't released about this. And the people who were part of the effort to keep it quiet haven't really been called to account.
Is part of the problem that this is such a dispersed thing? For example, some of these companies, some of these jails are run by for-profit companies. One in particular, the Corrections Corporation of America, runs quite a few, but there's not one group running it all, and so it's kind of hard to know who's doing what.
That's true. It's a hodgepodge. There's no question that this administration inherited kind of a mess from the previous administration. In this ballooning system, there are 400,000 people pass through. It costs $2.5 billion.
And how much per detainee? Do we have any estimates?
I think the estimate, and I think this is low, really, but the estimate that one hears is it's about $100 a day per detainee.
In August, you told us about the T. Don Hutto Center in Texas, where children were said to be wearing prison garb and were sometimes separated from their parents and not allowed toys in their cells. Is that still happening?
No. Well, Hutto is closed. There are still families at another family detention center in Berks, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, but it is not quite the same kind of setup.
Now, this has become an issue on another level because of the way some people, like Rush Limbaugh, have responded to immigrants from Haiti. I think he said, send them all back to help in the relief effort. How will Haitians in detention centers be treated in the next couple of weeks? You think they'll be released as a kind of an amnesty?
It's a very interesting question because one of the aspects of the law, as we understand it now, is that you're not really supposed to be detaining anybody except for the purposes of deportation or unless they're a danger. If you have someone who is not a danger to the community and you cannot deport them in the foreseeable future, and in this case, after all, there's temporary protected status, we're not supposedly going to be deporting people to the devastated landscape of Haiti anytime soon, they shouldn't be in detention.
I'm unclear as to who's being detained anyway, because if this is part of Homeland Security, I would imagine, people who might very well be potential terrorists, we would want to be detained. Perhaps criminals would want to be detained. But tailors, are they all part of the same thing? Or is anyone who doesn't have a green card or doesn't, whatever it is that Boubacar didn't have, Is anyone a criminal under those circumstances?
The pool of people who can be detained is really very, very large. Of course, there are people who are here illegally or who don't have a green card or in this sort of in-between status, who overstayed a visa. We're talking, easily 12 million people there. But there are also all these legal immigrants who, you say criminals, but you have people who may have committed a crime like two shopliftings, let's say, or a shoplifting years ago, and they served whatever sentence, a few days or probation, and they may not have had any criminal encounter since. That is considered under our immigration laws a crime of moral turpitude, and they can be deported.
Who's paying for all of this? We are as taxpayers?
We're paying for
I would assume that there is pressure on whoever is providing the services to keep the costs down as much as possible.
Well, I think, President Eisenhower used to talk about the military-industrial complex. I think we may have a little bit of an immigration-industrial complex going. It's a very profitable area now.
Well, as I said 5 months ago, President Obama promised an overhaul of the immigration detention system, but not until this year. So do we have any sense that there are new stages in the process that are being worked on?
I've been told that we should be patient, that this is a hard thing to do. They're putting in more managers or they're trying to hire managers to go into some of these larger private detention centers. But, one of the things that was most surprising to me in the documents that I found was that an official appointed to or rehired really to oversee detention health care, overhaul, is a woman named Nina Dazeritz, whose name appears as one of the managers who were discussing how to deal with Boubacar Ba when he was in a coma, how to shed responsibility for him.
So she was involved in the cover-up, and now she's going to be one of the people affecting changes. I think we may have answered this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway because a listener has written it in. Referring to Boubacar Ba, he was in America illegally, knew that he would not be allowed to return to America if he traveled to Ghana. Shouldn't he have expected to be arrested?
But actually, it wasn't like that. He had applied for a program through a private immigration agency. Now, they gave him bad advice. Unfortunately, there are a lot of these kinds of sometimes actual lawyers, sometimes notarios, whatever, who are peddling bad advice. But he applied for a green card. He applied for something called advance parole, which is permission from one arm of immigration, if you will, for him to leave the country. He believed he was going to be able to come back in, and in fact that he was on the path to legalize his status. And instead, his permission was canceled, was revoked while he was overseas. So when he showed up at the airport, he was on a list, and, you know, there it was.
Some of the cover-up has taken place in response to a National Public Radio investigation. Is it Daniel Wordling?
Daniel's Wordling, absolutely. I think that reporters over the years, Daniel's Wordling did some wonderful work in 2004, the end of 2005, that sparked congressional inquiries. There have been, as I mentioned, the Washington Post. We have been hammering away at this, but the reality is that the inquiries have tended to be stymied. What often happens is that local newspapers haven't, I think, picked up the ball the way they might have. These detention centers are around the country. If you go online, the Times website has the list of names. It has the video, and I think it's something that I'd like to see local reporters get into the act.
And we have links to that, to your full report on January 10th. People can find a link to it on our show page, and the special video about Boubacar Ba on the New York Times website. And my great thanks to Nina Bernstein for being our guest again on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.